This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
I was thinking of how... In addition to the four seasons, that here we have an additional two seasons. The season when the windows are closed in the Zendo and when they're open in the Zendo. It's a long wait, a well-deserved wait to wait for a day as this when we can open the windows. And it was a day something like this. When Dada Roshi climbed into the window downstairs, which is a nice way of saying broke in, but with the best of intentions, and found an empty building, a dining room floor covered with water, broken windows, and a vision. It's hard to imagine of what stuff one would have to be made of to come onto this property, see this building, have very little money, essentially no sangha, and think this is the place we will build a monastery. I am certainly not made of that stuff. So blessed are we that he was that person who came and took a mighty leap into not knowing, but also into a great faith in this Dharma. Because how else could this have happened but for that faith? And all of these years, you know, which to us, next year will be our 40th year. You know, that seems like a lot. In Buddhist geological terms, it's, you know, we've still got our birth water dripping off. But good for us. Good for us. You know, I think of all of the people who have passed through these doors, and, you know, I've said this before, that I, when I am in this building and I walk around and I see things like the rails going downstairs or the, you know, just different changes that were made to the building, other buildings, to the grounds, you know, very often I think of people, the person or the people that were involved in that. Who came and trained and received and gave. And that's how we're here today. And kind of in that spirit, I want to talk about accountability, which is, you know, sounds kind of dry and, I don't know, like ledgers and balance sheets, but let's look at it, see what we find. For those of you who are here at the beginning of Ango and for the forums that we did here and in the city, you know that accountability is one of the 10 values that we, the Beyond Fear of Differences group, came up with together as a way of, we call them values, but in a way they're practices, they're virtues, they're guidelines, they're, it's a framework to join the great tradition of lists and frameworks in Buddhism as guides to, in a sense, how to live together, how to train together, and how to create an enlightened society, and it's a society that is enlightened in mind, in body, and is equally enlightened and enlightening for everyone. The other values are trust and equity, courage, humility, reverence, generosity, the whole person framework, cultural fluency, and authenticity. And so I've already given a couple talks. I'll be wanting to give a talk on each of these. So accountability, we described as within the Mountains and Rivers Order Sangha, which means it's teachers, the abbot, it's teachers, seniors, monastics, the board, students, various councils, practitioners, everyone, that we're all mutually responsible for upholding these values and communicating with each other. And so what I've done is I've associated each of these with one of the precepts. And so, which is not an intrinsic association, it's something that I've done to link them to the teachings of the Bodhisattva precepts. And this one I've linked to the 10th great precept, experience the intimacy of things, don't defile the three treasures. And so what is accountability? To be responsible. To take responsibility, to be responsible for oneself, to oneself, to be responsible for others and to others. And it's an expression, you know, all virtues, all enlightened virtues are an expression of our enlightened nature, an expression meaning that it's how the enlightened nature is brought forth. The precepts are how an enlightened being lives in relationship to all things. Non-harming, fundamentally non-harming, based in reverence and compassion. and so to be responsible to oneself and to others, to bring forth this virtue, is to express our enlightened nature, which means it's a sign, you could say, of the enlightened mind, of an enlightened life, and it's also a practice. And all virtues are both practices as well as already endowed, virtues that we're already endowed with, that manifest more and more and more clearly, more demonstrably, as our practice develops. That's what maturing means in the Dharma. It doesn't just mean insight. It means to demonstrably, that is, in ways that we and others can see, those qualities. And accountability is an expression of our mutual codependence, which is redundant, of our codependence, that we are born together, we suffer together, we are liberated together, and we die differently. And so accountability is a way of speaking about this fundamental relatedness, which is based in our unity. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. And so all of these other qualities, patience and joyful effort, generosity, forbearance, loving kindness, forgiveness, and acceptance, they're practices. These are paramitas. They are elements or aspects of our practice, of our zazen, of what we do as practitioners. And they arise from our Buddha nature, our self nature, which means we already all have these qualities. And I remember in my early training having some considerable doubts about that regarding myself. And I just thought, there's just some of these qualities. I'm not sure. That's not true. I knew that I did, just because I thought, how could I not? I'm just a person. But they seem dim and inaccessible. But I sensed, I trusted that they were there. And so being manifestations of our true nature, they arise from non-greed. They arise from non-anger, from non-delusion. It's kind of an interesting way of putting it. And so when we manifest these virtues, these qualities, our lives are recognizably, to us and others, more peaceful, more resonant. There's affinity in the 10 directions, more flourishing. Our lives flourish. And as it says in the definition, that we uphold these values and communicate with each other, when we communicate these virtues within ourselves and with others through our intentions, through our words, thoughts, and actions, then we ourselves and those we live amidst, amongst, are more harmonious. And that's the essence of a Sangha. I mean, that's the basis of what a Sangha is. The virtue of harmony is a gathering of bodhisattvas who are bringing forth the enlightened mind and with it these enlightened virtues and committing ourselves to living in harmony together. When we don't do that, when we live against them, turn away from them, then there is inevitably remorse, there's sadness, there's fear, there's loneliness, isolation. So in that way, the Sangha is like a living, embodied aspiration. So we think of an aspiration as a very personal thing, our aspiration, bodhicitta. And it is, but when we come together, that aspiration becomes something that we share together, that we actually do together, we aspire together. It's not, there's a reason why we chant the vows and do liturgy in one voice. That we're merging our aspiration with the aspirations of others. We're merging our practice, we're merging our paths together to create an enlightened society, an enlightened Sangha. Martin Luther King spoke of a beloved community. Right? A community that he said was based in nonviolence, which we speak of as ahimsa, non-harming. It's really the same. And he said that, and he has various principles he laid out for how a beloved community is created, based in nonviolence and non-harming. And he said that this is a way of life for courageous people. It's a path, a way of life for courageous people. And so we see courage as one of these other values. We see courage as something that Buddhism recognizes, that the Buddha taught is requisite, is necessary for walking this path. That is one of the enlightened qualities that we develop. So accountability relates to our mutual influence. Right? That's what happens, is we come together wanting to realize ourselves, free ourselves of suffering, sort our lives out, to bring them into harmony. And we realize, oh, there are other people. And then we, as we are forging this enlightened Sangha together, we also get entangled, right? Because our karma is still active. And so in the same way that we're entangled, still entangled within ourselves, we entangle each other, which is really what happens in every relationship. You know, you're sort of bringing your karmic streams together and merging them together, and which is why it's important that we take responsibility, be accountable to ourselves and to each other. And so everyone has influence. All of us, every living thing, every inanimate thing has influence. Everything has influence. Everything exists in the world, fulfills its own virtue, and in that way has influence. And although everyone has it, it's not, our influence is not equal. And so Yasutani Roshi spoke about this in terms of the things that influence our influence, because we're always acting within a moment, a time and place, conditions. So karma never happens in a void. It's always happening within a time and place. And it's happening within also an historical time and place. So this moment's action, this moment's intention, doesn't just appear in this moment. The only reason it can appear in this moment is because of all of the previous intentions and actions that each of us have brought forth. And so the time that we're in, the time of day, the time in our lives, the time in history, the time in a sangha, influences, actions. The place that we're in, the physical place, we could say the place we are in our minds, the position that we have, our position to each other, in a sense we could say our position to ourselves, the levels, the ranks, the identities, the roles, and then degree. What kind of action is brought forth, right? How small, how large? So when Dogen says that there, and Buddhism teaches that there are three natures to every action, wholesome, unwholesome, and neutral, that's another way of saying that the influence of every action is spread across a spectrum from terribly unwholesome, right, extremely harmful, to neutral, you know, a very light or insignificant or neutral influence to profoundly beneficial. But because those actions occur within a place and time, always karmically, in terms of our consciousness, in terms of physically time and place, in terms of relationships, in terms of history, that each action is also includes or is incorporating and in a sense is responding to, is influenced by, and is influencing in turn social norms, customs, cultures, prejudices, histories, beliefs, the whole catastrophe. Which is just another way of saying that every action influences us and others. So everything we do is not just, that is outwardly directed, is not just influencing others, it's also influencing ourselves. And so our sense of self is not just thoughts or beliefs, right, or sensations. It's really the whole of our world has streamed into and been incorporated into our sense of self. And so this notion of a collective karma, you know, and I mentioned before that I asked Bhikkhu Bodhi once if he had ever come across a teaching of the Buddha's in which the Buddha talked in some way about a kind of the karma of a group or a collective or of a nation or a family or whatever. And he thought for a long time, you know, going through his library, his vast library of knowledge, and said no, he couldn't remember. But in the same way that we are a system, right, with many beings in our mind, you know, we can think of, you know, groups of people, whether it's a couple or a family or a sangha or a nation, in a similar way as having a consciousness and acting, right, and therefore and creating karma. But I think this is particularly important for us as practitioners today, and influenced no doubt by psychology and all of the vast wealth of knowledge and understanding that has come out of the study of psychology, as well as the place that the sense of justice has, you know, sort of arising in force with the Age of Enlightenment, and the sense that there is, should be, that liberty and justice and equality are virtues that actually should be brought forth and propagated and part of society. But I think also it's that the reason this is so important for us as contemporary practitioners is to save our world, to save our civilization. Martin Luther King, in talking about the beloved community, talks about love and the different kinds of love. And he says the love he's talking about is agape, which is the understanding, is understanding the basic goodwill for all people, wanting everyone to benefit, wanting everyone to be free. An overflowing love which seeks nothing in return, like dana paramita, like selfless compassion. He says, this is the love that may well be the salvation of our civilization. I think we can be a little bit more emphatic than that. And so I think for us, looking at karma and the teachings and practice in this way is in a sense, our imperative today. I think it's our calling. We are called to this as Buddhist practitioners. Because Buddhism so deeply and profoundly understands this, is teaching this, has taught this, but in a certain sense, for whatever reasons, sort of seen it in this collective sense, and not just seeing it, but actually, you know, taking it up and practicing it that way, has not been so much a part of the sort of the expounded teachings as we see. But today, I think too, because of the world that we live in, it must be. And so to be accountable to ourselves means to study. We have to study the self and see into our own mind, our attachments, our clingings, our kleshas, our attachments, our karma. Because that which we don't see is functioning. Everything we don't, I mean, whether we see something or not, just means it's either functioning within or outside of our view. So delusion, sort of the perfect delusion, is that we have no idea why things happen, and we have no idea why we're doing what we're doing, but we keep trying to make things happen. We keep trying to, you know, get the good stuff and get rid of the bad stuff. And so a perfect delusion is like being perfectly blind to ourselves. Now, no one is perfectly deluded. But it's kind of like when we keep a secret from others. There's an intentional desire to hide something, to protect something. So delusion is kind of an unconscious secret that is being kept from us. And it's like the most important news of all. Right? And we're the one who needs to know. Dogen says, unwholesome action is the manifestation of one of these three natures, wholesome, unwholesome, neutral. And then he says what is most important, that the unwholesome action nature is unborn, just as the wholesome and neutral action nature is unborn. And that these are non-defiled. That their nature, the nature itself is non-defiled, is unborn and undying, is undifferentiated, is non-discriminated, is free. However, he says, these natures are manifested in various ways. Dying on a moonless night must come forth in the day, in the sunlight of day. All nature is manifested in various ways. Emptiness is form. There is no other way to manifest. That's what integrating practice is manifesting. That's the theme of our Ango, manifesting Buddha. And so every action, every phenomena is unborn and undefiled. In and of itself, it is thus. Its self-nature is the nature of all things. All dharmas are forms of emptiness, not born or destroyed, not staying, not pure, with no gain, no loss. An action is just an action. An object is just an object. When the wind blows, it doesn't know. And so in the heat of summer, when it cools you, it doesn't know cooling you. In the midst of a storm, when it turns over houses and schools. It doesn't know tornado. It just moves. And it moves in accord with its conditions. Its earth conditions, its wind conditions. It moves in a perfect harmony with its wind nature. How that manifests for us, we perceive as pleasant or catastrophic. So all our influence on each other is like this. It manifests in various ways. And so we create hell realms, little tiny hell realms, and sometimes big hell realms. We create heavenly realms, little heavenly realms and big heavenly realms, all sizes. And so we as individuals, we as in groups, can create, you know, various forms of hell, and, you know, that we call injustice, or we call inequality, we call racism, we call poverty, we call the school to pipeline, or the school to prison pipeline, we call, have many names. Or we create justice, we create equality, we create compassion, a beloved community, an enlightened society. And so when the king of Bhutan in the 70s said that the gross national happiness is more important than the gross domestic product. To the ordinary world, certainly the capitalist world, that's like madness, crazy. To Buddhism, it's like, yeah, yep. Glad somebody noticed who has some power. And because every action within the sentient and the insentient world has influence, there is mutual accountability. It goes in all directions. We are accountable to the earth. The earth is accountable to us. Everything that is the earth belongs here. Everything that is human belongs here. And what allows us to be here in harmony is that we are accountable. We can ignore it, we can deny it, we can argue against it, we can try and sell it down the river, we can think we'll just keep ahead of it and try and hide the losses. But it's a fact. And so all of that is that secret, the self deceiving the self. And the self-deceiving others. And when we ignore something, it doesn't go away. It's where it always has been. But now it's happening outside of our awareness, which means it's dangerous, which means we're dangerous, which means things happen and we don't understand. Or we just don't care, which is worse. And so this accountability, this codependence, this mutual responsibility, this selfless compassion. What all of that means is that that is present in every moment, every moment. So being accountable isn't like just when we're talking to each other or we're engaging each other. It's because we're constantly engaging in relatedness with everything. And so that's a way of looking at why do we take care of things, right? Why do we straighten the zendo? Why does it matter how you put your shoes on the rack? You know, so we can look at that from the point of view of awareness, that when we're not paying attention, right, things get reckless and sloppy in small ways and big ways. Another way of looking at it is a way of expressing our mutuality. These shoes that protect our feet, that go with us wherever we want to go. They don't complain. Right? It's recognizing that we're in a mutual codependent relationship. And so they take care of us, right? But we cannot take care of them. And think, well, you know, I'll just get a new pair. This accountability is harder than a diamond. It cannot be broken. And it's softer than silk. It's not fixed. It's not static. It's ever present and it's ever changing. It's ever present and ever changing in its ability to liberate us, to close the gaps, to loosen the bonds of our suffering. It is bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is an expression of accountability, the great aspiration to liberate self and other, to liberate all of the many beings in my mind, in your mind, in all directions. Accountability is practice through and through. It is realization. It is experiencing the intimacy of things, not defiling the three treasures. Defiling the three treasures is to stand apart, and not just stand apart, but to willfully harm. So when we foul our nest, that's defiling the three treasures. When we turn against our mind, that's defiling the three treasures. When we don't take care of, or disregard, or diminish anything, that's defiling the three treasures. And so to not live within accountability is to turn against the three treasures, which is to turn against ourselves and everything. That's why it's painful. I mean, that's a pretty good system, isn't it? That when we turn against what's true, there's a message, like we get a signal. You know, think about if there's no indication, right? Which, I mean, what does that even mean? Then what would be suffering? But the fact that there's a message, right? We call it dukkha. And what that message is saying is that we have turned away, right? That there is a gap, a false gap that doesn't actually exist, but we perceive it as one. I mean, isn't that why dukkha for so many of us was, in our own experience of it, what brought us into practice? So one day a monastic asked Master Kaoshan, a child goes back to her parent. Why doesn't the parent pay attention to her? Kaoshan said, it's quite natural, like this. And the monastic said, but where is the love between the parent and child? Kaoshan said, the love between the parent and child. Monastic says, what is this love? And Kaoshan said, it cannot be split apart even when you hit it with an axe. The parent does not pay attention. This is quite natural. He's speaking from the ground of being. Dogen speaks to us from the ground of being. That's why it's hard to hear. It's hard to understand, right? Because we're listening from our frame of reference, which is dualistic. And so when he uses a word like refrain, it's like, okay, I know what that means. Why are you using it in some crazy way? It means this. But he actually is using it in a way that is meaningful and makes sense when we let go of the fixed frame of reference. And so this is how Kaoshan is speaking from this place. So when the parent and child face each other, I see you, you see me, then to not pay attention is harsh. It's cruel. And within the world of life and death, kindness is an expression of our codependence, of our accountability. It helps to close gaps. That's why Dhanaparamita is the first paramita. Not just because it's a selfless practice, but because it's a language everyone understands, and in giving, it helps to close the gap. And so even if we see and believe in the world as a place of opposites and boundaries, kindness, loving kindness, sort of passes through, breaks through that, and creates intimacy. When the parent and child have realized the unborn, undying nature, that giving and receiving are one, then it is quite natural that the parent does not pay attention Not paying attention is uncontrived. It is non-doing. It is in intimacy, there is no communication. Like reaching back for a pillow in the night. But the student says, but where is this love between the parent and child? As though it can't be seen, it's not being expressed. How is it ever not being expressed? And yet, it manifests in various ways. Because it reaches everywhere. It's not just bound between any two people. It's between everyone. And when we don't see this love, it's simply that. We're just not seeing it. When we don't experience it, we're just not experiencing it. That's all. Just because we do not see it doesn't mean that it's not fully present. And this love cannot be split apart even when hit with an axe. Heaven and earth are not two separate realities. So how is it that the slightest distinction seems to create them? How is it that that which is fundamentally undivided can appear so inarguably divided to us? That's the power of mind. That's the power of delusion. If the way is never apart from this body and mind, how can we turn away from it? How can we defile the three treasures? You know, it's like words. Words are just sounds we make with our tongue and our lips and our throat. Just sounds. And different sounds we give different meanings to. And the meanings vary. Right? Even though one word has this meaning, that meaning can vary based on time and place, based on how we use the sound we make, our expression, the person speaking it, the person hearing, the circumstances, our intention, all of these things infuse the meaning of this sound, which in and of itself is just a sound, something we give meaning to. And that meaning can originally be something practical or benign or instructional, and then it can evolve. It can evolve and become a weapon that is used against people, groups of people. And then that very same word can be taken back by that same group of people upon whom it's been used as a weapon and be used as a form of empowerment. The meaning is a result of intention and thoughts and convention and repetition and consequence. And at every step, the sound, the meaning it's given, the intention behind its use, its consequence, is unborn and undying. And it manifests in various ways. Helpful, hurtful. Accountability is to be deeply committed to understanding this. Because how else could we find peace? How else could we free ourselves from suffering? How else could we... Can we be confident in bringing forth benefit in the world? This accountability is every precept. As I said, it's bodhicitta. And just because we aspire to enlightenment doesn't mean that we won't continue to create harm. In fact, we can be pretty confident we will. And so that becomes something that we want to be particularly aware of, right? Because now it matters more because we're allowing it to matter more, right? Hogan was speaking yesterday about his experience growing up, and as you were talking, I was thinking of my own JD, juvenile delinquent experiences. And this is not a contest, by the way. Not at all. Because, in fact, I feel a lot of remorse for things that I did when I was young. But I was remembering, when you were talking, I was remembering one particular event. And hearing about the consequences of this thing that me and some friends did, hearing about the consequences on the 11 o'clock news while I was brushing my teeth, and my blood runs cold. And my father comes in, because on the news report they connected it to the school, and my father comes in and he says, "Do you know anything about this?" And in that instance, I told the truth. And I said, "Yes, but I didn't have anything to do with it." And he says, "What do you mean?" And I said, "I know who did it. I was there when they were forming the plan, but I knew this was the wrong thing to do. And so I just went silent." He said, "You're still responsible." He said, "Silence is not being accountable." And I so wanted to argue with him, but I knew he was right. And so because we know we will continue to create harm along the way, just because we are still following the path, we vow to this accountability. We vow to be accountable to ourselves and really to be held accountable within the Sangha. That's why when we take vows, we do it in public. So everybody can say, "Okay, I see. I was a witness. You took these vows. You mean this." And when we say, when the teacher says, will you live this vow? And we say, "Yes, I will." We're saying yes, not just to our teacher. We're saying that to everyone. "Yes, I will." Which means I will do my utmost to actually live this vow, to awaken and live as an awakened being. And I will do that within this field of accountability, because there is no other way. And that is my freedom. That is my liberation. Now I am free to take responsibility. So all of that energy, however much energy I put into blaming or making excuses or rationalizing or avoiding, which is just such a waste of time, now I can put into actually maturing. "I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time," the Buddha said. This is his great lion's roar of accountability. And so when we fall into discriminating consciousness, when we don't pay attention, willfully or unwillfully, when we act out of what we don't even see, and with good intention, we are still accountable because we have influence, because we have had an impact. And that's what matters. Of course intention matters. Because we can work with that, we can develop that, we can cultivate that, we can purify that. And we can do that no matter how we feel. And so it's a tremendously powerful force. But the influence we actually have is also within that field of responsibility. And so to whom are we responsible? Whatever living beings there may be, whether they're weak or strong, forsaking none, the great, the mighty, the medium, the short, small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and yet to be born, I am responsible to all. That is the Bodhisattva vow. It's not a distant, passive wish. It's very alive. And when we realize that our freedom, which we desperately want, we want to not suffer, we want to live this life. I think if we look deeply, we even realize we really do want an enlightened society. We do want. I mean, why is our current society so painful? So distressing? If we didn't care, we wouldn't care about it. It's because we want what we should want. We should want an enlightened society. We should want a beloved community. We should want to be awakened. And so that That heartfelt wish is, may I help all beings be at ease. And may I be at ease. May I not cause any being to be distressed, and may I not cause myself distress. That this responsibility is liberating. Right? But we have to trust that. And then just watch, pay attention. When we take responsibility, there are signals, right? There are affirmations. Yep. You're on path. That's right. Keep doing that. Even when it's hard. Especially when it's hard. May I help all beings be at ease, and may I be at ease. The Buddha said, if everyone knew as he did the real nature of things, then generosity would just naturally be spilling out of us. This is our enlightened nature.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.